This is Hugh LaFalle of Fridays Initiatives. On our show this week, our guest is Jeannie Allen, president of the Center for Education Reform in Washington, D.C., and we're going to be discussing education reform. Jeannie, glad to have you with us.
Hi, Hugh.
Thank you. I'd like to begin, I mean, if it's a Center for Education Reform, certainly the implication is that there's something profoundly wrong with the schools in the United States. Could you briefly summarize what you take the problems to be, and then we'll look at your proposals for how that could be changed?
Yeah, we actually think our role is a positive one. And even though there do need to be changes, and we argue probably more so than a lot of people that there need to be some real strenuous changes, that there probably can't be any better thing to be engaged in at this point in time. The problem with our schools and the education that the children receive is twofold. First of all, we have an enormous system that's grown by leaps and bounds over years and years, that with the growth of children, with the growth of the system, with the need for all sorts of new kinds of programs to handle all sorts of new and different and diverse kids, has come kind of a blockade to the old-fashioned, as horrible as that may sound to a lot of people, personalized classroom. There's a direct correlation between a school that reaches out to its kids, learns about its children, where people know each other by name, where everyone recognizes people's strengths and weaknesses, and how well the school does. And so we believe that first and foremost, the biggest problem is the system, not the kids, not the teachers. I underscore that. And we can talk, as you said, about some of those prescriptions without necessarily sounding like I'm looking for a throwback to Ozzie and Harriet. I do think there's an awful lot of things in history that we need to be doing that we're not doing as much anymore. But secondly, the actual quality and the question of what we are providing, how we know that the system isn't working, is based on a myriad of indications that we've had for the last 20 to 30 years about the lack of rigor that our children are accustomed to or being treated to, the lack of real substantive, core, high content in math, in reading, in geography, in history, you name it, such that when you see national assessments of education, when you even see state-based assessments, which are newer, but they're coming out more and more now, you find that when we do test kids, not compared to everybody else, when we test them actually compared to what they should know and what they are able to do, their actual achievement on basic tests in those areas I just mentioned come out a heck of a lot more below and far below where a lot of people thought they were. See, we're in a time where a lot of people don't recognize this, but for a good couple of decades, the only way we've known how well our kids are doing, and the reason we think they're all doing really well, is because they have been tested on norm reference tests, tests that basically compare me to somebody else, a group of control kids someplace that took the test. So when you say 90th percentile, your kid's in the 80th percentile, and they're going, oh, great, that's wonderful. It's like when your child is born, and, you know, they're in the 80th percentile, and wait, oh, great, good, they're above average, that's wonderful. Well, you're above average, what does that mean? About, you know, 20 years ago, that began to be debunked. What does above average mean? We found out that everybody in the United States was above average on these tests. That couldn't be. So we started looking into what that meant, and it turned out it didn't mean much. So we're right now on the heels of about 15 years of efforts to try to reform the system from within, create changes, create new kinds of programs, and we're still not any better necessarily for all that effort, time, and money.
All right, when we talk about the changes that you want to bring about, actually you hinted at them in your answer of what was wrong. Certainly one of the things that you mentioned has to do with standards. Could you say a little bit more about what you mean by the standards you would like to see in place in schools? You talk about the need for rigor.
Standards is a really complicated issue because it means a lot of different things down to a lot of different people. There's certainly a national debate going on, Hugh, where the president has called for national standards. There was an attempt a few years ago to try to put history standards in place for the nation, even though they were voluntary. A lot of people got upset because they didn't necessarily like what was in them. When I talk about standards, I think, in fact, when most, you know, really strong educators talk about standards, they're talking about setting a benchmark or a level, a minimum level, of mastery of a particular kind of knowledge. You know, you need to know by the first or third or fourth grade the following things or the following areas in history. By the end of first grade, you should be reading at such and such a level. You should be able to tell a story and name the characters. By the end of second grade, and if you're talking about English or language arts, as it's called, you should be able to put down on paper a complete summary, written in cursive, about a story. By the end of third grade, you should know your multiplication tables cold. You should be able to identify shapes. You should have some algebraic equations in there. So basically setting a barometer for how well our kids should be doing. States, I think, is the best place for that. Number one, it's not as highly politically charged in states as it is at the national level, but also it's easier to get down to the local level and get the buy-in, if you will, get the consultation of local teachers and school board members and parents at the state level than it is to be able to do this at the national level. But moreover, the state is where education is resting. And if anyone's going to hold kids accountable and schools accountable for how they do, it is the state. So standards and accountability are immediately come together. You have to have standards. You have to have some tests to measure the standards. You have to have some consequence. Do you get passed on because you now know this? Do you stay back? What kind of program do we put in place? That is a fundamental piece that is missing in most states. Lots of school districts have them across the country and use them really well. There's some great models out there. But those are pretty new and pretty unique. And now states are getting into the game, and I think it's going to be another several years before we see everybody doing it. But that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about the debate between state and national standards? Certainly one of the things that seems to me, I mean, I'm not an authority on the statistics here, is that one of the widest variations that we see in terms of performance is differences in performance between states, which would seem to suggest that if you leave it up to the states, those differences will continue. Would that provide a reason for having national standards of some sort to at least ensure that the differences in performance between states was narrowed, if not eliminated?
Theoretically, it makes an awful lot of sense. I'll tell you what the biggest problem is right now, though, is that we have a system and people, you know, it's very personal. You know, people is our policy to a large extent. You know, what they're doing in Pennsylvania, even though the math is the same in Arizona and should be the same, they want their thumbprint on it. They might not want to be as prescriptive as Arizona. They might want to be more general, let the schools do more. They might not think that their third grade level should be as strenuous. They might think it wants they should go a little farther. There are so many variations in terms of opinions and the people actually running the system that becomes very difficult to do, as much as it might make common sense. But there's another reason. The other reason is, if you do it at the national level, and let's say you have a very independent, nonpartisan, nonpolitical board and group of people that come up with great standards, and we all agree that they're terrific, someone's got to control them. Someone's got to administer them. And this is where we got into the problem with the history standards, and to a lesser extent, the math standards that the Council of Teachers of Math have created, and that exist in a very voluntary way among those folks. There are people who do not necessarily believe that it's right to expect kids by the end of third grade to know their multiplication facts cold. They might think it's not necessary. As long as they have a calculator, who cares about multiplication? Let's talk about concept. So there's a raging debate between math, among math people, among reading people, even among history people, about what it is our kids should know. And so if you have them at the national level, you tend to get into an awful lot more philosophy than most countries do. And it's interesting, most countries have a centralized education system. They don't have this problem in France. France has no problem coming up with really good, hardcore academic standards without all these kind of touchy-feely and debated mores and approaches.
Maybe we better move on. If we get time, we may want to come back to that later. One of the second things you talk about a great deal is accountability. Could you explain what you mean by accountability?
Accountability is holding somebody responsible for how well they do. That could be a school, that could be an individual educator, that could be a child, a principal. We don't have a lot of it these days. At the central to education reform as we see it, as part of our name, is this whole concept of accountability. Obviously, there's lots of debate about how best to get accountability. We think tests and standards are one way and should be something throughout the system. But accountability for results is not something people have, for a long time, had in place in their schools, which again is a surprise to most people. Most people think, okay, you don't graduate unless you've mastered a certain area. You don't go from first to second grade unless you've done it. There is a feeling on the part of the American people, a lot of them, less so than a few years ago, But still that, oh gosh, I wake up in the morning, I send my child to school, and they are going to teach him and make sure that he or she is learning and is going to progress, and I don't have to worry about it. And yet they do have to worry about it, because what we're finding out is the kids are graduating and they don't know what they were supposed to know. So why? Is it because the teacher? Is there a teacher that shouldn't be teaching? Is there a teacher that's teaching so well that she should be rewarded? How do you know that unless there's some sort of accountability?
But it's at that point, though, the relationship with the questions about standards comes back in. If an important part of the way in which you reward people or punish people is based upon standards, and if the standards are either not there or they're there but capricious, then you have a problem justifiably making people accountable for what students do and don't know.
Absolutely, which is why, as we've seen the practice of, say, state standards put into place, and we've seen, you know, regional meetings, meetings where hundreds of educators come, parents, people go around the state, they say, here's what we want to propose, what do you think, and they modify them. States like Virginia, who talked to over 60,000 people in the creation of their standards, Arizona, close to that, Colorado the same, have what people consider pretty strong standards that are almost exactly on the mark, that the officials there would argue are non-negotiable and need to be a part of the puzzle. Now, where their accountability begins to fall down, and it's something those states are grappling with, is, okay, so now we have a body of kids. They have these standards. The teachers know it. The teachers have been trained. Let's assume the teachers have been trained, because that's a big piece. What happens if those children don't meet it? Whose fault is that? It's not that we should be about placing blame, but let's face it. If those children do not learn, we would argue, and this is where we disagree with the unions and an awful lot of the people who are running the existing system, we would argue the teacher has an awful lot to do with whether those kids learn. That, yeah, they might come from really bad backgrounds and disadvantaged circumstances, but the bottom line is you can tell from a baseline. Here's where the child was when they came in. Here's where they left. If that child has made little or no progress, it's not just the child. In fact, one could argue, and who knows how much, but good teachers will say, I have every effect on my child possible. It's the teachers who aren't so great who are the ones out there screaming, we don't want that kind of accountability, don't blame us for society's failures. So the accountability question is actually much more controversial than even standards.
I'd like to pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this morning is Jeannie Allen, president of the Center for Education Reform, and we're discussing education reform. Let's move on to the third point, though I think it has connections with the others as well. The idea that there should be fewer regulations. Could you explain what sorts of regulations you have in mind, why you see them as a problem, and why they need to be removed or replaced or changed, or exactly what it is that we should do?
Well, people at the school building level for a long time have been the ones that are most frustrated with what they always say ties their hands to do more. Some of the answer to my previous, you know, suggestion that there's people sort of arguing over whether or not they should be held accountable or not, if we don't have the tools, we don't have the freedom, we don't have the flexibility. Again, one of the things that we know through, you know, regardless of what side anyone falls down on various issues, one thing that almost everybody who knows something about education agrees upon is that effective schools also allow their educators a large amount of flexibility. In other words, I'm a history teacher. I walk into a classroom and I decide, you know what? What we've been doing for the last week, the way I've been doing it, the books we're using, whatever, have not worked. I want to kind of throw that out for a week or two. You know, I'm going to postpone the assessment or the test I'm supposed to be doing. I want to jump out of the lesson plan. And I want to pay attention to a different kind of lesson, a different way, and bring in books. Most teachers would tell you they can't do that, not because they don't want to, and not because they don't think they should be, but because there are so many other demands on their time to account for what they're doing. The accountability we've had up until this point has been one of regulating inputs. How much are we spending? Let's make sure it's being spent the right way on the right stuff. And let's make sure the schools are accounting for what they spend in the quote-unquote right manner. Well, what that does is it sets up a system whereby teachers are filling out endless amounts of paperwork, where the schools, in order to defend themselves that they're spending Title I, Title II, state money, local money the right way, have set up a structure and a system that says, this is what we do on these days, this is what we do in this particular week, this is how we test our kids, this is when we test our kids. This is the class size we have. This is how many teacher aides we have. This is the qualifications of the teacher that we require. This is how many years we require them to be in the classroom. And it gets arcane. It's down to, you know, this is where we need to have a toilet. And the toilet has to be X amount of feet away from a first grade classroom. Phys ed regulations. It has to be no less than 2 hours a week, possibly three. It has to be at this juncture for these. I mean, you name it, every part of the curriculum, there is a rule or regulation that mostly comes from the state. And some from the federal, some are girded by the federal, or some the state do in response to the federal because they have to account for the money. And so you have this morass, you know, Governor Pete Wilson in California stood up one day last year as he was introducing some bill and said, and held up the code of regulations, said 7,000 pages of regulation. Who is grappling with these? Everyone from the superintendent on down to the teacher. And one could argue it has obviously an effect on a child. So when you sum it all up, you basically have a teacher and a school that is hard-pressed to step outside the box, that is hard-pressed to change what they're doing. They've been doing it so long, they've been doing it that way, and everybody has a certain pecking order, and yet they're not necessarily being held responsible for how well the school is performing and how well those lessons are translating into knowledge for the kids. They're being rewarded based on how they perform the tasks and account for what those programs are.
I mean, I, as someone who works in a university, I understand part of the point you're trying to make. I don't think that the regulations are as extensive in the university as they are in K-12, but they do exist. But there's a tension between the desire to give teachers more flexibility and the demand, on the other hand, for accountability. I mean, again, I see it at my level at the university, and I'm quite sure it's present at the lower level. As a professor, I think, yes, I ought to be accountable to the taxpayers for what I do. But it turns out part of what it means to be accountable establishes certain regulations and rules, paperwork I have to fill out in order to show that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Is there any clear and easy solution to resolving this conflict? I mean, for example, is the American public willing to trust their teachers?
Yeah.
Enough to say, do your job.
See, I think with the analogy to your job, you just hit the nail on the head. At the university, you are not necessarily operating under a full state system. I mean, all the regulations in your department are not necessarily there because the president of the university said it and the state said it and everybody else, you know.
Okay, most are.
Most are. But in some cases, that's not actually the case.
Right.
I think one of the clearest solutions and one of the things that actually restores the public's faith most in teachers, because there is a very big divide right now and has been for a while between parents and people on the outside and the educators inside. First of all, it's very difficult to be involved and to voice your concerns as a parent where parental involvement is an anomaly. Where it doesn't matter what you do. Okay, I don't like your reading textbook. I don't like what you're doing with Johnny. I wish that your history was more strenuous. And when they learned about the Declaration of Independence, they learned such and such. I wish when you were talking about slavery, you did X, Y, and Z. Well, guess what? That teacher can't necessarily do that because she's already had the lesson plan formulated for her. So parental involvement becomes very discouraging, and most people just keep their mouth shut. How do you get that back? I think how you get that back, how you get accountability back, how you get consequences back, and still hold schools and people to standards, is you take the operation, if you will, you take the onus for running schools away from these more distant bureaucracies that have been set up between our kids and the lawmakers to make sure these things are well carried out, and you give the schools the money. Okay, you've got 300 kids. They're worth in this state $6,000. This is your money. You, the principal or the CEO, you have a board, you know, or maybe you don't have a board, but you have a board, and those are the people who help you create policy, and you're going to be held accountable for your job for how well this money's spent, and you're going to be the line. See, what we've done is we've buffered all the account. Everyone's got shared accountability throughout the system. We've buffered them. So you really can't point and say, fire the guy. Get this guy out. Promote that one. They did a great job. There's so much that we're not responsible for that you really can't tell the principal, hey, you're out because these kids aren't doing well, because he didn't have responsibility to do that. So you give the money to the school. You give the school the ability to purchase their computers, their curriculum, to choose what they want. You give the teachers the ability to be the king or queen of their classroom. And you give parents the opportunity to decide whether or not that school best meets the needs of their child. That's the charter school concept, quite frankly, in a nutshell. The charter school concept is fairly new. What I just described is very old, and is something that people would argue they've been struggling for a long time. But it's something that you see in plentiful supply in private education. It's something you see are usually the hallmark, those things I've described, those characteristics, the money at the building level, the teachers that have autonomy, the choice of parents, ineffective schools. When parents move to really good school districts, quote-unquote good school districts, by all measures, they're choosing, they're voting with their feet. They're choosing to land themselves in a community. So while their child might automatically and mandatorily be assigned to a public school in that district, they've already made the choice of going there. So even in places where there's not actually public school choice, there's choice going on. And a lot of that is because they have the money and the freedom and the flexibility to do what they want.
Is going back to the question of trust, is that then a way of saying that in those situations the parents indicate a certain level of trust for the teachers will do the job?
Absolutely. I don't think there's anything more powerful than having a parent who makes a determination to be part of a school. And a teacher who suddenly doesn't have those shackles I described earlier, being able to wake up in the morning and say, gosh, I need to involve parents in this. I need to make sure they do X, Y, and Z. I want to make sure that everything's understood. They go out of their way, educators in these kinds of scenarios, to extend themselves. And parents go out of their way to be appreciative of their job and what they're doing. It's funny, we had, we're centers based in Washington, D.C., there was there's charter schools in Washington, and there's also a privately funded scholarship program that's helping about 2,000 children. And they recently had a lottery for this scholarship program. And a bunch of people in our building, single moms who work at various offices at our building, didn't get chosen in the lottery. And so they came to our office, and they're looking through our charter school directory for charter schools in Washington. And you know, I heard them talking to some of the other people in the office, and I went out to speak to them. I said, what are you doing? And they said, you know, we got so close to getting a choice. We don't want to send our child to the other school. And they were shopping. They were looking for something. And one could argue these were single parents. These are parents that are pretty much on hard times. They're vesting themselves. So they make that determination. They're vested in that school once they become a consumer.
I suppose it wouldn't hurt. To, as I mentioned earlier, I'm going to be doing a couple of shows on vouchers, but we've got a couple of minutes here. Probably wouldn't hurt to talk about a little bit more about the idea of choice, since that's an important element of your reform package as well. Could you elaborate a little bit on what you just talked about?
First of all, there's two things about sort of the reform agenda and what I think is conventionally known nationally as a reform agenda, which everyone from us to Democrats, Republicans, different legislators, different grassroots groups are onto. I think this is a really interesting time in education reform, Hugh, because it used to be that you could look at political sides and say this is what they believe, this is what the other side believes. Now the way I like to characterize it, obviously I'm not impartial, is there's the reformers and there's the status quo on the other side. The status quo is made up of the educational establishment, the unions, people who have a vested interest in the system as it is. They might want some changes. In fact, one could argue they're changing a little bit more and more every day because there's pressure from this other group of reformers who are saying, you know what, it's not the system we care about. Hugh Price, the head of the National Urban League, stood up at their conference earlier this year in New York City and gave a credible speech about education. And he said at the end, you know, make no mistake, we love our public schools, but we love our children more. And I thought that really captured what reformers are about. We want to do everything we can to maintain public education and to keep it going. But we also recognize that public education doesn't necessarily mean the same controls and the same institutions, the same government agency. It doesn't necessarily have to be one provider. Public education, I think, should be expanded. And in fact, one could argue the lines have already been blurred to include publicly run, publicly accountable, but privately run charter schools, contracting, which you see all around the country. Lots of different school systems are doing different things that they hadn't done in a long time. What does this have to do with choice? Well, part of that is, should we or shouldn't we allow children? For us, it's particularly children either in failing schools or that come from a deprived background. the access. If they don't have an adequate public school in their area, a safe one, a school that is doing really well or providing a good education, if it's a failing school, it's on, you know, all these states have failing schools lists. I mean, it's incredible to me and really sad that we actually, as policymakers, wake up in the morning and look at a failing schools list, as Florida and New York have, and there are kids going to those schools. And we're not saying, all right, tomorrow or today, we're going to do something about these kids. We talk about doing something about the schools. We'll give them 2 years to respond, then we'll take them off the list. Well, in the meantime, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, you're losing children. I mean, there's no question in my mind that how well we educate children now has every bearing upon everything from our society, our productivity, our welfare, the violence. So the school environment is really critical now. And I know that even people who disagree with me on the prescriptions understand that. I don't question their motives at all. But how do we get there, and how do we get there quickly? The concept of allowing a parent in a bad situation to have in their hands a mechanism, a scholarship, a voucher, if you will, that is worth the exact same or near the same amount as that child was being paid for in public schools to take to the private or public school of their choice and get out and buy their freedom out is something that is both inevitable, but it's also, I think, good public policy. We just witnessed the Wisconsin Supreme Court rule the Milwaukee School Voucher Program, which has been in existence since 91, constitutional. It's gone through ups and downs. It's been ruled unconstitutional, constitutional. There's a small, modest program in place that didn't include parochial schools. Legislature there, policymakers, elected by people, expanded it. They were sued by the union, the NAACP, the People for the American Way. They went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Unequivocally, the court said, providing for children to go to a school of their choice is not pervasively sectarian. This is not unconstitutional. It does not defy the separation between church and state. If we have police officers we pay for and they guard the outside of a church, is that sectarian? In other words, the public purpose, the public goal, is to get kids an education.
Okay. Thank you very much for appearing in the show.
Thank you, Hugh.
I've been speaking today with Jeannie Allen, president of the Center for Education Reform in Washington. This is Hugh LaFollette for Writers Nations. Good day.